World News Tonight debuted 3 months later on July 10, 1978. The new three-anchor format worked well. Within a year, the broadcast was tied with NBC Nightly News. ABC was doing just as well in the morning. Good Morning America was closing in on the Today Show and trailed my old alma mater by just 1.06 rating points. More important to me was the debut in June 1978 of an ABC News magazine program called, you guessed it, 2020. Rune Arledge had put 2020 together to challenge 60 Minutes on CBS, but it didn't get off to a good start. The inaugural broadcast, hosted by journalist Harold Hayes and art critic Robert Hughes, was a disaster, much too highfalutin. But from disaster rose a solution. A desperate Rune, who had uncharacteristically paid little attention to the initial program, was in a panic. Would I want to be the anchor? He asked. If I hadn't just gotten over my own recent anchor disaster, I might have said yes. But I just couldn't bear another audition and perhaps another disgraceful defeat. As luck would have it, my old colleague Hugh Downs, who was semi-retired, he was doing a program on public television for senior citizens called Over Easy, was substituting for a day as the host of Good Morning America. There he was for Rune to see, perhaps a bit bland but experienced and most of all, available. By the end of the day, Rune had hired Hugh Downs to host 2020. The opportunity for me to anchor the program went away, or so I thought. As it turned out, I would eventually join Hugh as co-host, and together we would preside with great success over 2020 for 15 years, and I would continue on the program after he left. At first, however, I was not officially attached to 2020 or any specific program. In a way, this was a very good thing. I was able to do a variety of stories that appeared on World News Tonight, Good Morning America, 2020, and for the first few years, Issues and Answers. Issues and Answers would be replaced by This Week with David Brinkley in 1981, when David came to ABC from NBC to host what became the most popular Sunday morning TV program. Some of the stories I did back then were big scoops. For example, in October 1979, when Jimmy Carter enraged the Iranians by allowing the deposed and cancer-ridden Shah to come to New York Hospital for treatment, no journalists were permitted to see him. It was rumored that the Shah wasn't really sick, and indeed wasn't even in the hospital. Because of my past relationship with the Shah, I was given permission by his aides to visit him in his hospital room. He looked very pale and ill. Over his bed was a big poster of a gorilla clinging to a branch of a tree with the caption, "Hang in there." I wondered who among his aides had the courage and the humor to put the poster up. I was not allowed to bring a television camera or even a tape recorder. All I had was my own Polaroid camera. I asked an aide to take my photo with the Shah, and we got just one picture. It was a Thursday. 2020 was then aired on Thursdays, and so, photo in hand, I raced to the studio, and we showed the proof that the Shah was indeed in the hospital in New York and exactly how ill he looked. I still have the tiny Polaroid photograph. 12 days after the hospital meeting, on November 4, 1979, radical Islamic students stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and took more than 50 Americans hostage. My photo of the Shah had nothing to do with it. The new Iranian government was well aware he was in New York. The hostages would be held for 444 days and lead Rune to create Nightline, hosted by Ted Koppel, to chronicle the crisis. The hostages would finally be released in January 1981, 6 months after the Shah died in Egypt. I caught the wrath of the fundamentalist government as well, though on a greatly reduced scale. While pillaging the Shah's offices, the revolutionary students found a taped interview I'd done with the Shah Banu and declared me persona non grata. Another early story for 2020 was one of the strangest interviews of my career. It took place on a lake in upstate New York in the middle of the night. The subject was Abby Hoffman, a former anti-Vietnam War activist turned fugitive from the law. Hoffman had been arrested in 1973 for selling 3 pounds of cocaine, a charge that could have brought him a life sentence. He had jumped bail the next year and been in hiding, under an alias, for 6 years. In September 1980, he decided to surrender, but in style. Several of his friends had called me in whispered conversations to ask if I would like to meet with Hoffman. It would have to be kept secret until he actually appeared. His appearance, it turned out, would be at dawn on a lake near the tiny town in which he'd been hiding on the Canadian border. At the appointed hour, my camera crew and I were in one boat, waiting, as Hoffman gradually emerged out of the early morning haze in his own boat. It was like a slow-motion dream, all very mysterious and theatrical. I did an interview with him at his hideout on land, in which Hoffman spoke about all the good works he'd done for the local environment while using an assumed name. He obviously thought it would help his case, and it did. He turned himself in the next day, and ultimately served 2 months in prison, followed by 10 months in a work release program at a drug rehabilitation center in New York. By the time I did that interview, 2020 had been on the air for 2 years. It had been doing reasonably well, with Hugh as the genial and well-informed host and his number one correspondent in those days, Geraldo Rivera. Geraldo did strong investigative pieces full of high drama. He and Hugh did a good many outdoor adventure features as well. But Rune evidently felt that the program could do even better if I, instead of just contributing pieces, joined up as Hugh's co-host. This time, I agreed. I wouldn't be doing the program by myself, and it was time for me to find a home at the network. Most important, I was fond of Hugh and knew I would not have another Harry Reasoner experience. For all our friendship and mutual professional respect, however, Hugh didn't want me as co-anchor. He didn't want any co-anchor. He'd been doing the show solo from its outset, and he felt doing it very successfully. So at first, he resisted Rune's insistence that the show would be better with me there. To his credit, Hugh told me exactly how he felt. But Rune was the boss, and Hugh finally agreed. Once he did, we never had a bad day. As with the Today Show, I did the tough booking of the high-profile guests, and Hugh continued to do the kind of lower-key and easygoing, but often dangerous features he did so well. Very popular features like swimming with sharks, maneuvering a glider, or instructing viewers on how to sail a small boat. Hugh wanted and got top billing. That was fine with me. I remembered Bing Crosby's advice. Hugh therefore opened the program, and I closed it. "We're in touch, so you be in touch," was our warm and cozy sign-off. The show was undeniably stronger with the two of us. "I don't know when I've been happier to have been wrong," Hugh told me. In time, 2020 became one of ABC's most successful weekly programs. On occasion, we even topped 60 Minutes in the ratings, although 2020, first on Thursdays, then on Fridays, was in a much more competitive time slot. I also continued to do 4 primetime specials a year. They were so time-consuming that I wanted to fold them into 2020, but they were too popular for ABC to give up. Instead, Rune took them away from the entertainment division and put them under ABC News, where they remain to this day. This meant increased revenue in Rune's budget. My permanent place on 2020 and the continued specials meant more hard work, but at long last, I felt I could stop auditioning week to week, or more often, day by day. Things were smoother professionally, but they were more complicated at home. Heartbreak and a New Beginning. My mother and my sister continued to live in Miami after my father died. Their life without my father should have been peaceful, but they were more and more alone, totally dependent on each other, and, I think, frightened as well. My mother worried constantly about what would happen to Jackie when she died. Jackie, I think, worried too, and the unspoken question was whether I would take her to live with me. I ached, knowing that I just couldn't do to myself what my sister unwittingly had done to my mother. The two women, instead of cherishing each other, constantly argued. Tears from Jackie, doors slamming, phone calls to me, each complaining about the other. Their discontent tore at me. One of the problems was their isolation. My mother would not go out without Jackie, which meant she was rarely invited anywhere. Other widows and single women lived in their building in Miami, and I urged my mother to make some coffee, buy some danishes, and invite a few of them to the apartment to watch my specials. She'd reply, "It's too much effort," or, "They want to play cards," or, "They don't want to come." So she and my sister would watch the specials alone. There's an old joke that every woman in television knows. You do an interview with the President of the United States, and your mother says, "I didn't really like your hair." My mother was true to form, but to her credit, she was no stage mother. As proud as she was of me, she never said to friends or acquaintances, "Did you see my daughter on TV last night?" or told me that so-and-so wants a picture for her niece. She never used me to enhance her life. I did my best, however, to enhance her and Jackie's life. I visited them whenever I could, and if I went to Florida for work, I would try to include them in whatever I was doing. I was a guest on a show Phil Donahue did in Florida, for example, and I took my mother and my sister. They had a wonderful day, and Donahue could not have been kinder to them. I enjoyed opening the world up to them, even if just a little bit. I also invited them regularly to New York, but that was often a trial. My mother didn't want to pack and make the trek for less than 3 weeks. So this meant a stretch of almost a month of hearing them argue and cry while I became the unwilling referee. They were each right, they were each wrong, and they were both so sad. I hated to come home at the end of the day. At least we had more room at home. In 1978, thanks to the job at ABC, I bought an apartment on Park Avenue and 62nd Street and hired Angelo Dogna, a brilliant and much sought-after interior designer, to decorate it. Since my old apartment had been so dark, I asked him to make everything white. My bedroom, the living room, everything white. The apartment was lovely and airy and bright, except for the kitchen. The prior owners had painted the kitchen bright orange. It would have taken 4 coats of white paint to cover it up, and I didn't want to spend the money, so orange it stayed. It was the first home I'd ever owned, and, the kitchen aside, I loved it. My daughter Jackie finally had a proper bedroom, and there were large rooms for Ikodel and Zell. We also had a guest room where my mother and sister slept when they visited. The high point of everything for my mother was seeing her granddaughter, whom she adored. By 1981, Jackie was entering a very troubled adolescence, but to my mother, she could do no wrong. Where some people talk about the problems or complications that may arise with adopted children, I never, ever heard my judgmental mother say anything but the most wonderful things about Jackie. This was her grandchild, period. It was during one of my mother's visits to see us that she had a terrifying health scare. She woke me up in the middle of the night because she was having difficulty breathing. We rushed her to the hospital to discover that her heart was failing and she had fluid in her lungs. She spent some time in the hospital and eventually recovered, but for a long time she was frail and depressed. When she was released from the hospital, I couldn't let her go back to Florida, so I experimented with putting her in what I thought was a nice home for senior citizens in nearby Riverdale, New York. She and my sister had their own little apartment and any supervised care that was needed. The bonus was that the director of the facility found work for my sister at the nursing home on the grounds. Bless him. He told Jackie that she was to be a secretarial assistant, and she seemed quite happy spending a few hours a day running errands, filing, whatever she was capable of doing. I thought this might be a perfect solution for my sister in the future. If anything happened to my mother, Jackie could continue to live in the residence. All her meals were served in the dining room. She had begun to make friends among the women she worked with. She would have a life there and still be close to me. I never discussed this with my mother, but I hoped she would realize the possibilities on her own. She didn't. My mother disliked the home, and that killed any chance for the conversation to take place. She insisted there was no one there with whom she had the slightest thing in common. What she really wanted to do was live with me, and in retrospect, perhaps I should have found them a small apartment nearby. But then, what would happen to Jackie if my mother died? Then came the second health scare. My sister had a small lump in her breast, and it turned out to be malignant. My mother and I decided not to tell Jackie she had cancer. The diagnosis would have terrified her. We told her that the lump was harmless, but should be taken out. Jackie was fine with that and asked very few questions. I took her to the best doctors to determine the course of treatment. One suggested a mastectomy. Another said a lumpectomy would be just as effective, and there seemed to be growing evidence that that was true. I could not discuss any of this with Jackie. I thought it would have frightened and confused her. My mother left the decision entirely in my hands, so I decided on the lumpectomy. It was terrifying to hold my sister's health in my hands. My decision could literally be a matter of life or death for her. To my everlasting relief, the treatment worked out. Jackie had the lumpectomy at Memorial Sloan Kettering, the world-renowned cancer center in New York, and followed it up with radiation. The hospital suggested a very fine and understanding radiologist in Riverdale, near where Jackie and my mother were living, and my mother took her there every day for the many weeks of the treatment. Things went smoothly, and Jackie never realized that she had had breast cancer. My mother continued to be unhappy in New York, though I suspect she would have been unhappy anywhere. What she saw as the burdens of her life had robbed her of any joy. She had been such a loving mother when I was growing up, and I still loved her dearly, so I kept trying to find things that would give her pleasure. It was a difficult task. One Thanksgiving, I put together a dinner at the Friars Club. There were 12 of us at the table, my daughter, some cousins, and a few of my friends who were alone for the holiday. I had bought new dresses for my mother and sister, and they looked lovely. Henny Youngman and Red Buttons, two comedians who were old friends of my father, came over to our table and made a big fuss over my mother. I thought she was having a good time, until I suggested that everyone at the table tell the rest of us, in turn, what he or she was most thankful for. When it came to my mother, she looked around the table and said, "I have nothing to be thankful for." My heart sank. My mother missed the warm weather in Florida, and after Jackie's radiation treatments ended, they returned to Miami. I found them very nice accommodations at a small spa-like residence that provided meals and social programs. Jackie loved it and happily attended painting and dancing classes. My mother, too, seemed more or less satisfied. Although I often thought when I heard them arguing with each other that I would never be free, I felt now that perhaps I could relax. But over the next months, when I telephoned my mother, she often seemed disoriented. Sometimes she didn't recognize my voice or even my name. My sister said mother was often like that and spent more and more time in bed. I called Aunt Lena, my mother's sister, who was still living in Miami Beach, and she confirmed that my mother was forgetting things. She did not even want to get up for meals and seemed to be losing track of time and place. My aunt had been worried, but didn't want to bother me, hoping that my mother would get better on her own. I phoned my mother's doctor. He also confirmed what Aunt Lena had told me. One thing was clear. My mother needed full-time care. I flew down to Florida. I took her in my arms and brought her to the same nursing home to which she had brought my father. My mother barely knew what was going on. Could I have brought her to New York and, with nurses, kept her with me? Of course. But I didn't. I struggled with that decision. I remembered when I was a child telling my mother that when I grew up I would build her a house and we would all live together. That house was not a nursing home. I knew other children of aging parents were facing this kind of terrible predicament, but their dilemma didn't help mine. Shirley also tried to make me feel better. She reminded me of what I knew, that my mother had put my father in a nursing home, and Shirley had put her own mother, my Aunt Rose, in a nursing home. She wouldn't have gotten the level of care at home with me. The outcome would have been the same, and it would have destroyed my life, Shirley said. It will destroy your life, too. Shirley's advice was particularly apt. My personal life had entered a new stage. I was in my early 50s and had been single for 12 years. My work was stable, and I was going out more and more with Alan Ace Greenberg, now the CEO of Bear Stearns. He wanted very much to marry me. He was dear to me, and I felt I should take the plunge and marry him. The problem was that although he was the nicest, smartest man, I didn't think I was in love. Then, in the summer of 1984, I unexpectedly met another man, Merv Adelson. Wham, I thought, at last, this is it. I was really attracted to Merv and knew that if he felt the same way, my indecision would be over. It soon was. We met on a blind date. Our Cupid was an advertising man named Leo Kelmanson, my neighbor in West Hampton, where I rented a summer house. Leo told me he had just sold his advertising agency to a very successful man from California. He was one of the founders and owners of Lorimar Productions, a television company that had a string of huge hit shows like Dallas, Knott's Landing, and The Waltons. He'd also co-founded La Costa, a fabled spa and resort in Carlsbad, California. Merv is going to have to come to New York often now for the agency, Leo told me. He's recently separated from his wife and very attractive. Would you like to meet him? Why not? Merv called, and we had dinner. Leo was right. He was very attractive. His hair was silver, his eyes were blue, and he had a year-round tan. He was sexy, funny, and charming, and to me, very California. Just the sort of man I'd seen in Vegas when my parents were living there, and who didn't have any interest in me. Nor, I'm sure, would Merv have been interested if I hadn't become Barbara Walters. Not that he was interested in celebrities. He was, after all, in the television and movie business, and had dozens of beautiful actresses working for him. But I was something different, not an actress, yet someone who understood his world. No sooner had we sat down than Merv, to my surprise, launched into a confession. The money that he and his partner had used to develop La Costa, he told me, had come in part from the Teamsters Union Pension Fund. The Teamsters Union at the time had a reputation of being involved with organized crime. Penthouse Magazine had run an article in 1975 that implied that Merv, too, was associated with the mob. That charge was untrue, Merv insisted, and he had sued Penthouse for libel. He had lost the libel suit in 1982, 2 years before our dinner, but the judge had granted him a new trial. He wanted me to know this up front, because the legal issue was not yet resolved, and the rumored mafia connection was a blot on his reputation. All this before the main course. I appreciated his frankness. I also found it endearing that Merv was being protective of me and my reputation, when his libel case didn't really affect me. We were just having dinner, after all. A delightful dinner, which ended on a funny note. Merv had no cash for a taxi to get back to the Pierre Hotel, so I loaned him $5. I guess he was so used to having his car and driver pick him up in Los Angeles that, like Queen Elizabeth II, he didn't have to carry any money. A week later, he sent my $5 back with a cute note, and we made another date. We began to see each other a lot over the summer, and I realized I was falling in love. It was a wonderful, rare emotional experience, and despite my family problems, I was happy. Merv seemed bigger than life. He skied, rode horses, played golf and tennis, sailed. He wore jeans and t-shirts when every man I knew in New York was wearing navy blue suits and ties, and he lived as if there were no tomorrow. Merv had a beautiful estate in Bel Air, which I visited, and where later we would live. We spent time at his ranch called the Lazy Z in Aspen and his house on the beach in Malibu. He also owned an apartment in a hotel in New York, though more and more often he stayed with me, which is the major reason I didn't bring my mother to New York to live with me. I anguished about it, but I decided there was no way I could continue my new relationship with Merv and have my mother along with round-the-clock nurses in the apartment. And what would I do with my sister? So in the summer of 1984, my failing mother went into the nursing home in Florida while my sister continued to live at the small residence with the social programs. I tried to find Jackie a roommate as a companion, but it proved close to impossible. I then approached the Hope School for the Intellectually Impaired, which they were now called, where Jackie had done some limited work years before. The school had opened a residential home where she could live in one of several two-bedroom suites and be supervised and cared for. Jackie could also resume her activities at the Hope School, filing and running errands for the assistant to the principal. That's where Jackie went. She didn't like it. She wanted her own apartment in Miami Beach. "Why can't you find me a roommate, Barbara?" she would ask over and over again. I would try to explain the difficulties, but she wouldn't listen. "Where there's a will, there's a way, Barbara," she'd tell me. They were always on my mind, my mother and sister, but I didn't discuss it very much with Merv. We were beginning a romance, and I didn't want to inflict all this on him. From the little I did tell him, he was very kind and supportive. He also was developing a special relationship with my daughter. When Jackie met him, she instantly adored him. Merv was fun and hip and outdoorsy, as was she. He had three children himself, one of whom, Ellie, wasn't too much older than Jackie. There was the possibility, dare I say it, that we might become a family. I had met Merv in May. That October, after I moderated the first presidential debate between Ronald Reagan and Walter Mondale, we went on safari to Africa with another couple who were dear friends of his, Joanne and Gil Siegel. We laughed our way all through Africa. Never in my wildest dreams did I imagine I would be camping in a tent in the African bush for fun, but there I was, and it was magical. Elephants, wildebeests. I'd never heard of a wildebeest before. Zebras and lions by day, vodka in our tent by night. Who wouldn't have fallen in love? Merv and I got engaged while walking on the beach in Malibu in June 1985, a year after we met. By this time, I had eased out of my relationship with Alan Greenberg. He is now married to a terrific woman and remains my friend to this day. So there I was, in 1985, engaged to be married, with more than a full-time job at ABC, a rebellious adolescent daughter, and an ailing mother and dissatisfied sister always on my mind. "My stomach hurts," my sister told me one day over the phone. I didn't think much of it. Jackie tended to exaggerate a cold into pneumonia. Nonetheless, I called the school and asked them to make sure she saw a doctor. The second call from Florida was devastating. Jackie's test results had come back. She had advanced ovarian cancer. I was heartsick. It had never occurred to me that Jackie might die before my mother. I flew immediately to Florida. To my relief, the doctors told me that this cancer had nothing to do with her breast cancer. I don't know how I could have borne it if it had turned out that this cancer was a result of the decision I had made when she had her lumpectomy. Ovarian cancer is a secret killer. There are some tests you can take, but they're often inconclusive. A woman rarely knows in advance if she has the disease. The doctor told me that he wanted to operate right away to remove Jackie's ovaries. Her condition was that serious. I quickly called my friend, Dr. Paul Marks, at Memorial Sloan Kettering. My instinct was to have my sister flown to New York to be operated on, but I was torn. The doctor who was treating her in Florida had a warm bedside manner and had established a rapport with Jackie. She would need more than medical care, and I thought she was more likely to get loving personal attention in Florida than at the large, more impersonal Sloan Kettering. Paul Marks agreed. He knew Jackie and understood that she needed a doctor she trusted to supervise her post-operative care and the intense chemotherapy she would require. So we went with the doctor in Florida. I stayed with Jackie for the surgery. It went well, although there was a strange side effect. I sat with her in the recovery room after the operation, and she kept repeating, "I'm so sick, I'm so sick." But she never stuttered. Not once. The stutter had disappeared. To this day, I don't know why. I remained with Jackie for 2 days after her operation. Then I had to leave for Milwaukee to make a long-scheduled speech, after which I planned to return immediately to my sister in Florida. I was backstage at the convention hall, waiting to go on, when I got a call from Jackie's doctor. "I have terrible news," he said. "Your sister got out of bed to go to the bathroom and had an aneurysm. There was nothing anyone could do. She didn't suffer at all." My God, Jackie was dead? It couldn't be. She had seemed weak when I kissed her goodbye, but all the signs were that she was recovering well. I was numb with shock and guilt. What was I doing in Milwaukee instead of staying by my sister's side? She died all alone. I, too, was alone in that dreary backstage room as the waves of guilt and sorrow hit me simultaneously. I sobbed, trying not to make any noise. No one heard me. And then I dried my eyes and went onto the stage to make the speech. What does that say about me? I don't know. Maybe I don't want to know. I just did my job, which seems to be what I do no matter what the circumstance. Maybe it's the way I cope. I didn't tell anyone in the convention hall that my sister had just died. I gave a terrible speech and was criticized for it. I didn't give a damn. Jackie was dead. My difficult, temperamental, tragic, loving sister, who had played such a huge role in my life. I remembered all the mean thoughts I'd had about her as a child and the frustration I'd felt toward her as we grew older. Then there were the decisions I had had to make for her as we became adult women. Had I made the wrong decision having her surgery in Florida? Would she have had better treatment in New York? Merv sent his plane to Milwaukee to take me back to Florida. We buried Jackie in the same cemetery as my father. We have a family plot there, and it is where I'll eventually be buried as well. My cousin Selig and his wife, Marvel, flew down from New York for the graveside ceremony performed by a local rabbi. My Aunt Lena came, as did my cousin Shirley, along with her two sons. A few people came from the Hope School as well. It was a very small, sad group. I decided not to tell my mother that Jackie had died. Her mental state was confused enough, and I knew that my sister's death would be too difficult for her to deal with. As it turned out, to my surprise, my mother rarely asked me about Jackie, and when she did, I lied. I told her that Jackie was staying with Carol Channing in California. My mother, knowing that Carol had always been very kind to Jackie, accepted that and seemed satisfied. To make sure that my mother did not find out about Jackie's death from anyone else, I told only my closest friends and asked them to keep it a secret. I was afraid the media would find out and report it, and that could lead to someone in the nursing home saying something to my mother. I gave up consolation for discretion. It was a poor substitute. My mother's condition continued to deteriorate, and her periods of lucidity grew shorter and shorter. I flew down to see her once a month and brought along my daughter as often as possible. Sometimes my mother knew who I was, other times she didn't. "Who are you to me?" she'd say over and over, and I would say, "I'm your daughter, Barbara." Somehow she always knew that Jackie was Jackie. She had a very strange kind of selective memory. Sometimes she didn't even know who she was. "Who am I?" she would say. "Well, Grams, who do you think you are?" Jackie would lovingly tease her. When she did recognize me, she would beg me to take her out of the nursing home and bring her back to New York. I spent hours discussing it with Shirley and finally decided, now that my sister was gone, I could do that. But I decided not to move her into my apartment. Merv and I were engaged. He was virtually living with me, and I worried about the strain on both of us if we lived with my deteriorating mother and round-the-clock nurses. Instead, I took a suite for her in a hotel across the street from the apartment, staffed it with nurses, and visited her every day. But she was unhappy there. It was a decision I still go over in my mind. I think perhaps I should have brought my mother into the apartment. These are ghosts that don't go away. In the midst of all this, Merv and I got married. True to form, I had twice postponed the wedding. The first time was in the fall of 1985. I began to have doubts and didn't go through with it. Then we were supposed to get married during the Christmas holidays in Aspen. Again, I couldn't go through with it. I had growing reservations about Merv. He was wonderful company for the most part, but he could be very moody, and that cast a cloud over our relationship. I also worried again about the instability of marrying someone in show business. I tried to convince myself that Merv was primarily a businessman, the same rationalization I had adopted before marrying Lee. But just as Lee had produced one Broadway flop after another, Merv had already branched out into making forgettable and not very successful movies. There were rumors that his company might be in trouble. How could I repeat that mistake? But my biggest concern was the bi-coastal life we would have to live. In spite of the fact that my friends all truly liked Merv and he seemed to like them, he really didn't like New York. He had been born in California and lived there all his life. It was home. As for me, I didn't think I could move full-time to California. I couldn't do 2020 from there. It would have meant giving up my career. So we decided we would spend 10 days together in New York, 10 days together in California, and 10 days apart. I was able to make arrangements with 2020 to pre-tape the program the weeks I would be in L.A. I rationalized that for two busy people, our schedule might even make for a better marriage. But in my heart, I worried. The arrangement might work for a year or two, but for a lifetime? Planes? Plans? Time differences? Separations? How many years could we go on like that? As it was, Merv was already beginning to come to New York less and less, and I was staying less often in Los Angeles. When I was there, we spent most of our free time with his grown children, whom he wanted me to really get to know. I liked them very much, but it meant that Merv and I had little time to really sit down and talk. The truth is, we didn't have that much in common. He was a great athlete. He liked to play golf, tennis, and ski. I did none of those things. I liked to read and see friends. Merv had few friends, and reading was not a great pastime. On Tuesday, May 6th, 1986, I flew to California to break off our engagement. Why do I remember the date? Because we got married 4 days later. The sun was shining when I arrived, the garden was blooming, and Merv was charming and funny and tan and handsome. What was the matter with me? Jackie already considered herself his daughter. Her feelings for Merv meant a great deal to me and might even have tipped my decision. So on Saturday, May 10th, 1986, I became Mrs. Merv Adelson. Just like that. Fast, so I couldn't change my mind again. I didn't even have a dress. I borrowed one from a friend, swallowed a Valium, which I never take, and more or less zonked my way through the wedding. Actually, it was a very sweet ceremony. We got married in Beverly Hills at the home of good friends, the noted film and television producer Leonard Goldberg and his wife Wendy. A few other friends scrambled to make it from New York, and there were quite a few pals from California. My dear and trusted agent Lee Stevens gave me away. Jackie was my maid of honor. Beverly Sills, the famed soprano, who was very close to me, read Elizabeth Barrett Browning's sonnet, How Do I Love Thee? Jackie and a friend of hers sang, That's What Friends Are For. It was all extremely touching and lovely. As it turned out, the marriage was nice too for quite a few years. Because we had gotten married so quickly, we decided to have a big party that fall in New York at the Pierre. I spent our entire honeymoon in the south of France seating and reseating the tables. Every time I finished a table, somebody dropped in or dropped out, and I had to redo the table. What honeymoon? All I was doing was tables. I have learned since that you seat the tables no earlier than the day before the party. It was the grandest, most elegant party anyone could ever have had. We hired a party designer who turned the hotel's grand ballroom into an arbor of beauty, festooned with garlands of sweet-smelling flowers and centerpieces of roses, orchids, and tulips on each table. 300 people came, from Brooke Astor and Mary and Lawrence Rockefeller to my old girlfriends from college and their husbands. All my New York friends and colleagues came, as did Merv's pals and business associates from Los Angeles, and of course, both of our families. Everyone got along. There was singing and dancing, champagne and laughter. Howard Keel, the great baritone and one-time star of Kiss Me, Kate, was then appearing on Merv's show Dallas, and he sang a beautiful love song dedicated to me that night. Only he sang it to the wrong person. He sang it to my cousin Lorraine, who looks a lot like me and was sitting at the same table. She was thrilled. The only shadow over the wedding party was provided by the Wall Street Journal, which 2 weeks before had run a front-page story dredging up all the old stuff about Merv's association with the mafia. But it was only a tiny shadow. Merv and his partner had settled the libel suit against Penthouse out of court before we married. Merv even had proof that the allegations of his links to organized crime were false. Bob Guccione, the owner of Penthouse, had written him a letter, saying the magazine had not meant to imply that Merv was a member of the mob. Nonetheless, I had to deal with the article, and I did, with my toast at the party. "I would like to thank the Wall Street Journal for underwriting tonight's party," I said. "I wish they'd had to arrange tonight's seating." Everybody laughed, and everyone then accepted Merv. Merv sold his apartment at the Pierre after we married, and together we bought a beautiful apartment where I live to this day. I finally got away from the orange kitchen. As for my poor ailing mother, her health continued to slip away bit by bit. Sadly, she wasn't even able to come to the party in New York. She barely knew me. Yet she was still the mother I adored, the mother who put bows in my hair when I was a child, who cooked breakfast, lunch, and dinner for my sister and me, and lavished love on both of us. This is the woman who used to tell me when I was a child that she wished she had 6 of me. As I grew older, whenever I had to leave her, she would hold my face and kiss me over and over again and tell me how much she loved me. Yes, she became a depressed, unhappy woman in her later years. Yes, she wasn't easy to be with, but with all the sadness in her life, I could never really blame her. She saw the cup half empty. She made me determined to try to see it half full. She died in June 1988 at the age of 91. I was in California for my daughter's 20th birthday. Jackie was going through a very difficult time, and Merv and I were giving her a party. I felt it important that I be there, but I was terribly torn. My mother seemed to be getting weaker, although her doctors didn't consider her condition critical. Then, while I was in California, she slipped into a coma. My cousin Selig, of whom my mother was very fond, went to see her, and he advised me not to fly back to New York. "She won't even know you're here," he said. So against my better judgment, I stayed in California for my daughter's party. Maybe my mother wouldn't have known I was there, but I'd have known I was there. I'm sick of telling you how guilty I feel. Suffice it to say that to this day I can't bear to watch a film in which an older person dies in his or her child's arms. I dream about my mother all the time. We buried her in Florida. Standing in the cemetery, looking at my father's and my sister's graves and then burying my mother, I realized that after all those years of worry and responsibility, I was finally, finally free. But it didn't give me a sense of exhilaration. There was a touch of relief, but mostly there was sadness and regret. I look often at a favorite photograph I have of my parents and sister that sits on a table in my apartment. It was taken many years ago at the Latin Quarter. Jackie is blonde and smiling. My mother and father are smiling, too. It was a happy moment before the series of sad and difficult events that followed. I treasure that moment. When I think back on my family life, there were not nearly enough of them. The hardest chapter to write. Of all the chapters in this book, this is the hardest for me to write. I think it should be a chapter of its own because if my sister, Jackie, was the centerpiece of my youth, my daughter, Jackie, is the centerpiece of my adult life. There is another, perhaps more important reason. I love my daughter more than I love anyone in the world, always have. But when she reached adolescence, our life together became extremely difficult. I would probably not have written about this at all, but Jackie feels that it is very important for people to understand what she and I went through because she hopes it may help others. Her thought is that if we could make it, and we did, it may give hope to other parents who are struggling with their own adolescence hard-to-understand emotions and rebellion. It may also help working mothers feel less guilty, because when your child is in trouble, the first thing you do is blame yourself. A troubled child can be from any family, but I think working mothers like myself feel the pressure even more keenly. And so, I am sharing our most painful years, which in truth, I would rather not remember. I am not sure how Lee and I getting divorced affected Jackie. She was only 4 at the time and says she does not remember how she felt. She never heard us arguing because we never did. It was just that suddenly her father wasn't living at home anymore. We carefully went through the route that most divorcing parents do. "We both love you, darling. Our separation has nothing to do with you. You did nothing bad. We both will continue to see you, etc., etc." Jackie seemed to take all this in stride. What actually happened was that her relationship with her father was never the same. Lee loved Jackie very much and saw her at least 2x a week. He took her on wonderful vacations, skiing trips in winter, pretty houses in the summers, and one August he even took her to Venice, Italy. But she never felt close to him. Jackie was 19 when Lee died. Today she says she regrets that she didn't know her father better. His photograph is in her home, but although I never remember saying a bad word about him because there were no bad words to say, I could not help her accept and enjoy him. "He tries too hard," she would tell me. "He lectures me." Indeed, the time came when there was a good deal to lecture her about. As a little girl, Jackie could not have been more adorable. We played games together in the afternoon, took baths together. We spent almost every weekend together, often with Shirley, who adored her almost as much as I did. Summers, when Jackie wasn't with Lee, I, too, rented a house on Long Island. My parents and my sister visited, and they couldn't keep their hands off her. My father took Jackie for walks in her stroller and enjoyed his little granddaughter as I don't remember him enjoying my sister and me. It gave me great pleasure. I never did know how little Jackie felt about being named after Big Jackie, especially when my daughter was old enough to realize that her aunt wasn't as smart as she was. But I thought my Jackie had a pretty happy childhood. She doesn't seem to think so. Jackie was never with an unfamiliar babysitter. If I was away, either Zell or Ikodel or both were with her. But in spite of all the continuity of this love and attention, Jackie grew up with no sense of self. Her theory is that almost every adopted child feels a sense of loss and suffers from what she describes as inner abandonment. This is something she thinks an adopted child lives with her whole life. Add to this, Jackie was exceptionally tall. When she was about 2, my then assistant, the aforementioned Mary Hornicle, measured Jackie's height and said, "If you double the height of a 2-year-old, you will know how tall she will be. Jackie measured more than 3 feet then. I was furious with Mary, but indeed, Jackie is now almost 6 feet one. She is also very beautiful, with those big blue eyes, a glorious smile, with one dimple in her cheek. We used to joke with Jackie that we could only afford one dimple. But striking as she was, Jackie only felt big and awkward. In addition to the effects of the divorce, there was my traveling not only around the United States, but to France, Germany, the Middle East, China, everywhere. True, Jackie always had Ikodel and Zell to come home to from playdates or school. But did my working and traveling make a difference to her sense of security? When she was a little girl, I would take her in my bed many nights, which we both loved. Then I would carry her into her own bed at 5 a.m. when I went off to work. I never saw her at breakfast time except on weekends, and never took her to school. But I also never missed a school event or any special occasion. Every birthday was celebrated with great love and attention. Still, I will always have the doubts most working mothers, certainly of my generation, felt. There was also the question of my growing celebrity. I never realized that it would make a difference to Jackie. I had the same friends, none of whom were celebrities. We lived comfortably, but not luxuriously. Our home, it seemed to me, was very normal. Still, Jackie now says she never really knew if a school friend liked her or liked the fact that I was her mother. It took her almost her whole life, until she had accomplished so much on her own, to come to terms with her identity. I may have unwittingly contributed to her confusion. From the time Jackie was a tiny baby, I vowed to myself that I would not burden her with any of my problems or frustrations. I would not be like my own mother, who confided in me probably too much. I would keep my problems to myself. And I did. But you know, it is probably true that as much as you try to profit from your parents' mistakes, you make others they didn't make. By not telling Jackie my problems, challenges, hurdles, I perhaps did her harm, for she didn't realize that I, too, suffered sometimes. Instead, she grew up feeling that she just couldn't begin to compete with what she saw as my accomplishments. She didn't know until she was an adult that there were also prices I had to pay. She certainly didn't know that as a child. When it came time for nursery school, I sent her off to one in the neighborhood so that either Zell or, when possible, I could pick her up at noon at the end of the school session. Jackie seemed to like the little school, although I have this very clear memory of one Christmas celebration. Parents were invited to hear a chorus of about a dozen little ones sing songs of the season. Jackie had a sweet voice, and Lee, Zell, Ikodel, Shirley, and I all looked forward to hearing her. But when the children started to sing, Jackie, and only Jackie, turned her back on the audience. All we saw was the back of her head. When I asked the teachers why this had happened, and if Jackie needed special help or attention, I was told that this occurred very often, and that Jackie was just shyer than some of the other children. Nothing to worry about. Today, I think it was something to worry about. Getting a child into private school in New York is notoriously horrendous, so I was very happy that I had good contacts at the Dalton School, considered to be one of the best in the city. It was also co-ed, and I thought that Jackie, coming from our all-female house, should get to know that boys existed. Dalton was large for a private school. It went all the way through high school, and the kids more or less had to be self-starters. It was also known as a place that gave special attention to each individual child, and Lee and I thought that would be good for Jackie. So we applied, and Jackie was accepted. Not only that, she was chosen to play the number one angel in the kindergarten Christmas play. This time, she faced the audience. By this time, too, Lee and I had separated, but we came to the play together. All seemed fine. As the years went on, however, things did not seem so fine. Jackie had a few friends, but she said, wistfully sometimes, that she was not really accepted by the girls considered the most popular. This reminded me of my own childhood, and though I never showed it, I worried for her. Occasionally she would invite one of the so-called popular girls to the house for a sleepover, but they never seemed to invite her back. Jackie acted as if it didn't matter. On Valentine's Day, she sent a valentine to almost every child in the class. She received few back. I ached for her. Again, Jackie said it didn't really matter. Of course, it did. I went to see her teacher and the school psychologist. Not to worry, I was told, girls were cliquey. As for boys, Jackie was inches taller than any of them. If she went to a party and the kids played spin the bottle and the bottle happened to point toward her, the boys would often say, "Ugh." Today, I think that is why those popular girls shunned her. The boys didn't want my big, awkward daughter around, and the girls wanted the boys. None of this did I know. None of this did Jackie tell me until much later. As for schoolwork, she did okay in general and excelled in art. Unfortunately, neither the school nor Jackie considered that a very important accomplishment. When I talked with Dalton about possibly transferring Jackie to a smaller school where she might do better, I was told again and again that next year she would do better at Dalton. Was this because I was a celebrity? Did the school just want to keep her name on the roster? Could I have done more? If I had not been concentrating so much on my own work, the tough hours, the necessary travels, would I have known more? When Jackie got to be 14 in 1982, it was as if a teenage warning bell went off. Her grades fell sharply. Up until then, Zell had helped her with French, and I struggled to help her with the math, but that didn't seem to be enough. We hired special tutors for both subjects. Then Jackie, who could walk home from school to our new Park Avenue apartment, started to come home later and later. One day, I went to surprise her by meeting her after school, only to be told by one of the girls that she had left early. The girl looked at me kind of funny and said, "She's with the boys on 84th Street." I ran to 84th Street. There, I found my daughter with a small gang of tough-looking boys, smoking and leaning against the cars on the street. They disappeared when I appeared. I took Jackie home, and in tears, she told me that she was in love with one of them, and she saw them every day, and there was nothing I could do about it. The boys, or rather young men, were called the 84th Street Gang. The next day, while Jackie was in school, I revisited the 84th Street Gang. I told the leader that if Jackie was ever seen with them again, I would have them arrested, and that this was something I could do. They later told Jackie what I said and told her to go home. Jackie promised me that she wouldn't see them again. It was a promise she never meant to keep. I never told Lee. Jackie was barely 14. I couldn't imagine that things would get worse. They did. Jackie began to sleep later and later each morning. I couldn't get her out of bed. By this time, I was no longer on the Today Show, so I was home in the mornings. I would shake her, sometimes pour cold water on her. Nothing woke her. Drugs? Not my child. There was even a television special with that name. If I mentioned drugs, Jackie swore she wasn't on any. I never found marijuana in the house, but I probably wouldn't have known, as I had no idea what marijuana looked or smelled like. But it wasn't pot I had to worry about. Much later, I learned that Jackie was on amphetamines. She was swallowing all kinds of pills. No wonder she couldn't get up in the morning. Fortunately, she didn't like cocaine and never got into hard drugs, but the pills were enough. Remember, this was more than 25 years ago. We didn't know about kids and drugs the way we do today. Besides, I had never touched pot or any kind of a pill, except the Valium I took before I married Merv. I couldn't recognize the symptoms. Jackie barely finished Dalton that year. I made plans for her to go the next fall to a small girls' school in the city that seemed to be so desperate for students that they said they would accept her. But her behavior got worse. When she finally did wake up in the early afternoon, she would scream at Zell and me, bang out of the house, and return when she felt like it. She dressed all in black with tons of makeup. She would not tell me who her friends were, and short of having her followed, I couldn't find out. Our relationship was coming apart. Some days she all but refused to talk to me. Yet with it all, she never ever said to me, "You're not my mother." She never touched one of my things or stole anything to buy drugs. In calmer moments, she would hug me and tell me she was sorry, and that she knew how much I loved her and that she loved me. By this time, though, I knew we were in desperate trouble. I went to a child psychologist for advice on how to handle my daughter. I also wanted Jackie to go to the doctor and get the help she needed. She kept one appointment and absolutely refused to go again. All this time I was appearing on television, the picture of composure and tranquility. It was a nightmare. Finally, I realized that Jackie needed to get out of New York City. Lee and I agreed to send her to an all-girls boarding school in Connecticut, since closed. On the surface, it was a lovely place, pretty buildings, lots of trees. The headmaster was out of a movie. English accent, tweeds, charming, sure he could help our little darling. He couldn't. Jackie started to refuse to come home on weekends. She had a new friend named Nancy, whom the school kicked out midterm for bad behavior. She and Jackie had been found in the nearby town, high on God knows what. My daughter, though, was not told to leave. The school obviously didn't want to lose Barbara Walters' daughter. After Nancy was expelled, we heard that once or twice on a weekend, Jackie had gone to Boston to visit her. When I got the name of Nancy's parents, her mother seemed not to know whether Jackie visited or not, and said that Nancy, then 15, lived her own life. I told the school that Jackie was never to be allowed to visit again. I didn't know what else to do. If I took Jackie out of the school, where would I send her? It was around this time that I met Merv. He and Jackie immediately took to each other. She said that she could talk to him. This gave me some hope. I was so grateful to Merv. The school year finally came to a close. It was now 1985. Merv and I were engaged. What to do about the summer with Jackie? I heard that the Parsons School of Design, a well-regarded school with all kinds of artistic programs, had a summer session in Los Angeles for high school students. Great, Merv and I would be spending time at his home in Malibu. I had a close friend in Los Angeles with a daughter Jackie's age, and they knew and liked each other. So we made plans for the two girls to take a summer course and live at Parsons. Jackie liked art and agreed to go. For a moment or two, things seemed as if they would work out. 2 weeks into the course, Jackie disappeared. She had run away from the school with someone who, I later learned, was Nancy. Frantic, I got in touch with a wise and experienced friend, Dr. Mitchell Rosenthal, who runs Phoenix House, the foremost drug rehabilitation center in the country. "Don't call the police," Mitch advised me. He said I would end up on the front page of every newspaper, which would make Jackie hide even further, or perhaps induce someone who saw her to kidnap her. Could there be a greater hell? Days went by with no word. There was neither good news nor bad. I was going crazy. During that time, Mitch and I made a plan. When we heard from Jackie, because I had to believe I would soon hear from her, he would arrange to have a transport person pick her up and help us decide what next would be best for Jackie. Transport men and women are brave and experienced people whose business it is to find wayward or difficult children and, usually, against their will, transport them to either what was known as an emotional growth school or, if necessary, to a lockup facility where they could be treated. Mitch put me in touch with one such man. His name was Mike. I will forever be grateful to Mike. During this short time, I visited three schools as well as Mitch's own facility, Phoenix House, so that when we did find Jackie, we would know where she should go. The one I liked best was in the Midwest, about a 2-hour drive from the nearest city. It had no train station, no airport. It was hard to get to and hard to run away from. It has since closed, but it was one of the first such schools that primarily treated adolescent boys and girls like Jackie, who had no mental illness or criminal behavior, but were suffering from severe problems ranging from drug abuse to general rebellion. The school didn't stress academics. It had no psychiatrists or even psychologists. Instead, by strict rules, many hugs, outdoor wilderness activities, and a great many group experiences, it attempted to inspire in the kids a feeling of personal identity and self-esteem. It was a 3-year program. The school felt it couldn't really accomplish much in less time than that. 3 years seemed a lifetime to me, but the kids I met there seemed relatively happy and told me the school was helping to change their lives. When Jackie was finally found, I decided I would send her there. By now, almost 4 days had passed with no word from Jackie. I decided, front page or not, that I had to call the police. Then the phone rang. It was the sister of a man Jackie was hitchhiking with. Her brother had stolen Jackie's wallet and gotten our home number. He was a bad man, she said, and told me not to give him anything. She did not give me her own name, but told me where Jackie was, thank God, and gave me a phone number. It was in a Midwestern state. My heart in my mouth, I telephoned. After a great many rings, a woman answered. I asked for Jackie. She got on the phone and said she was fine and didn't want to talk to me. Did she need money? I asked. Yes, she said. She and Nancy wanted money to go back to Boston. Fine, I said. Give me your address and I'll send you both airline tickets. Maybe Jackie was tired of running. She told me later that they had hitchhiked across the country, ending up in the home of some guys they met. They were all stoned. How she was still alive, I will never know. She says she doesn't know either. Anyway, she gave me the address of where they were staying. I was all sweetness. Immediately, I called Mitch Rosenthal. Don't do a thing, he said. I'll send Mike. Jackie told me later that Mike, who was a very big man, bigger than Jackie, arrived at the rundown house in the early morning hours. The door was open, and Jackie barely protested as he carried her off to his waiting car. He took her to a place where other transport counselors brought their runaways and spent a good day and a half talking with her. He then called Mitch and Merv and me and said that Jackie was essentially a good kid. He didn't feel she needed any kind of a lockup facility. Indeed, he said, she almost seemed relieved to have been removed from the house she was in, and he thought the school I had chosen would be a good place for her. We arranged for Mike to bring Jackie there at once. Jackie later told me she was actually glad to go with Mike. She was becoming afraid of Nancy and didn't want to see her again. She never has. As I said, the school was a hard place to run away from. The path leading into town was long and forbidding, and the town itself was so small that any new face would be quickly noticed. The kids lived in wooden dormitories, boys and girls separated. As the school got larger, the older kids helped to build some of the structures for the newer kids. The counselors, many of whom had themselves graduated from the 3-year program and decided to stay on, seemed to know just how much toughness and how much affection to give the kids. All the music the children listened to was carefully chosen. Only selected television programs or movies were permitted. If a child lied or misbehaved, he or she was considered not to be clean. Appropriate steps were taken. Mostly, the students were forbidden to talk or be talked to for a matter of hours or days. The regimen was strict, but supportive. Parents could take their children out at any time, and some did, but the school advised strongly against this. Give the program a chance, they advised. Above all, the children were told they had to be totally honest, both with the counselors and, most important, with their parents. For the parents, this was often torture. It certainly was for me. When Jackie was first brought to the school, she was allowed one phone call to me. Sobbing, she told me how sorry she was, how she would never, ever do anything like this again. She had learned her lesson. Could she come home, please? Don't leave me in this horrible place. Please, please, please. I was shattered. but I just knew she needed more than I could give her at home. Sobbing myself, I told her she had to stay. She hung up. As bad luck would have it, the day Jackie telephoned was the day Merv had arranged for the whole cast of Dallas, Lorimar's huge television hit, to go to the city of Dallas itself. There, a big celebration was planned. Merv had begged me to participate and to make the cast introductions. All I wanted to do was to stay in bed and pull the covers over my head. The last thing I wanted was to take a plane to Dallas and fake a smile all day. It brought back to me the day my sister died, and I was far away making a speech. But Merv had been kind and concerned about my daughter, and if this celebration was important to him, I felt I had to go. I went with the brightest lipstick and the heaviest heart. I must digress now. Please, parents, if you are having an experience like this, I know it may be the most difficult decision of your life to force a child to stay in a place where you can't be totally assured that it will truly make a difference. Your own heart may be breaking, and the easiest thing is to remove your child from the program. But if you have any confidence that it will work, hang in there. It may be your best and perhaps only hope. For the first 3 weeks after Jackie entered the school, I was not allowed to talk to her. Her advisor counselor, who had herself gone to the school, told me Jackie was adjusting. She also said she knew what I was going through and to call her own mother, who would tell me of her experience and perhaps make me feel better. I did so, but I don't remember feeling any better. My first phone call to Jackie 3 weeks later was not much more successful. After a few calm minutes, she again began to cry and to tell me that everything was all my fault. "Par for the course," said her counselor. A month after that, along with other mothers and fathers, I went to visit Jackie for the first time. Lee was already suffering from brain cancer and wasn't well enough to go. Later, Merv would come with me on his own plane, and we brought Lee and his wife Lois with us. When I arrived that first time, Jackie greeted me with a smile and a hug. I had not seen her in 3 months. She looked healthy and happy, but said she still wanted to come home. I told her that wasn't possible. Then, over a 2-day period, she made her required confession and told me things about herself I never wanted to hear and have tried sometimes to forget. She told me of her unhappiness, of her continued drug use with uppers, downers, and marijuana, even if I couldn't smell it. She had tried LSD and didn't like it. She also told me that she had not stopped seeing the head of the 84th Street gang. He made her feel wanted, she said. She stopped seeing the gang only when one of them went to jail. I was in shock. How could I not have known that all this was going on? How could I not have known how unhappy she was? And yet, finally, I was hearing the truth, and there was relief in that. I didn't know what would happen next, but I believed that Jackie was on her way to a brighter, better chapter in her life, and my eyes were finally opened whether I liked it or not. We could proceed with honesty, and we have ever since. While Jackie was at the school, Merv and I married. The school gave Jackie permission to come to our wedding. My memory of my wedding day is all tied up with Jackie. She stayed at the school until she graduated 3 years later. When she turned 18, she could have legally left. At first, she wanted to, but Merv, whom she loved and trusted, wrote her a long letter. Jackie had told us of an experience she'd had when, as part of the school's program, she had climbed a mountain. She said it was very tough, but she had felt great when she accomplished it. Merv wrote that if she stayed at the school, it would be another mountain climbed and an even greater accomplishment. She chose to stay. As for me, the experience at the school was almost as great as it was for Jackie. We had our own parents' weekends where we listened to the counselors and the children. I learned how to love my child without being judgmental. I learned what buttons not to push. I never missed a weekend when parents were allowed to visit. I became very close to the other mothers and fathers who knew me as another parent, needing to hear and share experiences. Yes, they knew I was Barbara Walters, but most of all, I was Jackie's mother. During those years, I saw Jackie slowly change. She developed self-reliance, especially, she said, during days and nights spent alone on wilderness experiences. She learned that there were other kids whose grief was similar to her own. She could cry and rant and rave about how unfair life was to her, and no one was shocked or critical. She learned that some of the other children did not have the support or love from their parents that she had. In her last year at the school, she was elected vice president. She was also helping some of the new kids adjust, who were as defiant and frightened as she had been. A fairly large number of these children, she told me, were adopted, adding to her theory of their special feelings of inadequacy. Jackie's graduation day when she was 18 was glorious. She wore a white dress and big smile, and it was as joyous a day as we could have had. I couldn't have been happier if she had just graduated Phi Beta Kappa. What a road we had traveled. Jackie still had a long way to go. Everything wasn't hunky-dory. But I supported her in every possible way from then on, and our relationship became closer and closer. She never lived in New York again. Jackie feels the city is too big and too cold for her. A great place to visit me, she feels, but not to live in. For a while, she lived in Seattle with a girl from the school. She tried marriage, but it didn't work. Finally, Jackie moved to Maine because it seemed to have the same climate as Seattle, but was closer to me. You will never guess what she did, or maybe you will. With her former counselor from the school, she opened a small residential outdoor therapy program for girls called New Horizons for Young Women. Her partner didn't want to stay in the East, so Jackie eventually bought her out.